Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here do not necessarily represent the views of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, some underwriting announcements. This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, in Urbana. For more information, visit centralillinoisjwj.org. And this program, Labor Hour, is supported in part by the listeners of WFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The only World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, the GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WFT Community Radio. Okay, folks, well, we have a new co-host of the World Labor Hour. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, this is Gus Wood. PhD student in the Department of History at the University of Illinois, also co-president of the Graduate Employee Organization. I want to give a shout out to the entire GEO and my great co-president, Rebecca Pulsifer. I'm excited to be here with David. We got some exciting topics to go with today. So,
indeed. Yeah. And welcome, Gus. We're just pleased and honored to have you on board with us and everything. Just to let you know, Gus is going to be doing his own program once a month. And, of course, he'll probably pop in to join us in our other programs during the month. But we wanted to give him a program just for himself to kind of focus on topics that he thinks are very important and stuff that are labor and community related. So I guess you have some news stories this morning?
Yeah, definitely. Of course, everybody knows that the big topic of the week has been President Obama's State of the Union address. So the show today is really going to focus on how we as a community and how we as Americans can move forward with President Obama's address and how we felt about it. One of the first big news stories that are coming out today, well, not today, but it's been out in the past couple of days, actually, has been the Labor Department has released its report on jobs. And of course, it's exactly what President Obama said in the State of the Union address, which we'll talk more about in detail, that jobs have increased the most they have since 1999. But the problem is something that the president failed to mention and a lot of other people failed to mention, is that wages have not only stagnated, but they have regressed in a lot of industries. Timothy Noah writes in Politico that the picture for wages both through 2014 and over the past decade and a half remains dismal. And as a result, stagnating wages have displaced unemployment as the nation's chief economic concern. And wages have become a central political concern, too. So what you have is you have people getting jobs that are no longer viable to support a livable situation for a nuclear family. And of course, other people who have grandparents or other members of family living with them, they cannot support them on these wages. You know, that's something we have to deal with. Another part of this story is fast food and Walmart workers join U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Labor Secretary Tom Perez, and other national leaders at the first ever Raising Wages Summit hosted by the AFL-CIO in Washington this past week. Heading into 2016, additional state-based summits on raising pay for low-wage workers will take place in the early primary states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, with the goal of holding politicians accountable who fail to make the topic a central focus. And I've always told David that this is a key thing for me in my research and what I do in my activism, is that we cannot elect politicians unless they are public servants. That's why I don't even like to use the term politician. As a public servant, your job is to serve the people. And if you don't have that as your central goal, you should not be in a position of power. So I think that this is a great thing that's happening in these states. I'm very sad to see that Illinois is not one of these states doing this, but this is something that we can definitely bring to the table with the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, indeed. And, yes, indeed. I didn't know about that. That's really, that's a great step forward. I mean, you know, starting with the 15 Now campaign, and now it seems like it's moving right along, you know, building momentum. That's great.
Yeah, but one of the things that we're going to talk about later on the program too is this building 15 is that as these wages start going up in certain areas, the cost of living still does not match those wages. So you have places where they're going to get $12 an hour in a couple of years, but by that point, it's going to have to be $17 an hour to match the cost of living. So the way capitalism is set up, there's always going to be a profit that you just cannot, that your wages will never be able to match.
Yes.
Unless we change the way we do minimum wage. But that's something that we're going to talk about later on. So that's one of the biggest stories that we're going to talk about in general is how can we get our wages to match the capitalist system and the cost of living skyrocketing across the nation. So another major story that's coming out. Another major story coming out, unfortunately, out of St. Louis right now is we have another teenager who was shot by St. Louis police. St. Louis police shot and killed 19-year-old Isaac Holmes late Wednesday night, the same day that the New York Times reported that the U.S. Justice Department would not pursue federal civil rights charges against Darren Wilson, the Ferguson police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown last August. St. Louis police claimed the victim tried to get out of a stolen car and point a 9mm pistol at the officers, but these claims were contradicted by a witness who told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch he did not see a gun. Again, we are faced with a very disgusting element of society where somebody's life is being taken away by an authority figure and these authority figures are held by this system saying, we are not going to allow you to challenge how we police this country. It's a very disgusting thing. And the fact is, we still don't have people talking about the fact that a man's life has been taken by abuse of power. When are we going to hold these authority figures to a standard that every human life not only matters, but has power in this country as people?
You know, it's, in third world countries, you have both the military and the police forces that are basically completely separate autonomous entities under themselves, basically that any leader that gets elected or comes into power always has to consult with those because they're a power unto themselves. Is that what we've come to? I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, New York City is a perfect case in point, I think. But by the way, I did hear that there's going to be a rank and file challenge to that president of the New York City Police Department Union, Patrick Lynch, and that when he tried to get officers to sign cards stating that they're killed in line of duty, that they don't want Mayor de Blasio to come to the funeral, he only got 2% of the police department to sign him and return him. So
Wow. That's
kind of, you always got to look at, this is an interesting topic. I mean, with the police, because, you know, in labor history and our history of our country in general, granted, the police are working class, but, it's just very, very rare in our history where the police have ever refused orders, when they're given orders to, like, say, you know, bust heads, striking workers, or even, you know, harass, beat, and even kill striking workers or members, like now what's going on in inner cities and stuff, rarely have they basically refused. And the really sad part about this is now in a lot of larger, especially the larger city police departments, you have a lot of people of color who are police officers, but they seem like they get sucked into the that whole dynamic. They think of themselves as cops first and, working people or, you know, members of their, community second at best.
Yeah. I mean, it goes into the idea of how the police were formed. I mean, historically, the police were created solely to protect private property and keep the workers or the slaves back then away from being able to gain some type of opportunity into the very small private property sector, the capitalist area of the country. That's the only reason they were created. So you have this foundational on inequality. And that was put forth as a central goal of the police force. So when you have people who go into the police force, they basically have to adopt this edict of I'm better than those people. And of course, the majority of African Americans and Native Americans and Latinos are working class or sub working class. So we face the brunt force of the issues that go on with the police. Mm-hmm. So it's a foundational issue. And until we address the system and not a component of the system, we're going to continue to have these stories where innocent lives are lost.
Yes. Yes.
So. And just to piggyback off that story too, there was another shooting in December, on December 30th of last year.
New Jersey?
Yeah, New Jersey. Okay. Jerame Reed. On Tuesday, this past Tuesday, police in Bridgeton, New Jersey released dash cam footage showing that police shooting of Jerame Reed. Reed was shot 9 times as he was attempting to exit his vehicle and get on the ground after a routine traffic stop with his hands up. Reed was sitting in the passenger seat when Bridgeton officers Brahim Days and Roger Worley stopped him and Leroy Tutt late at night on December 30th for running a stop sign. The footage shows Days walking to the passenger side window casually to ask for Tutt's driver's license. The situation suddenly escalates when Days claims to see a handgun sitting in the glove compartment, drawing his own gun on Reed and Tutt and shouting orders for them to raise their hands. Police have not since confirmed who the alleged handgun belonged to, only confirming that a gun was revealed and recovered at the scene. The video shows Days reaching into the window and pulling out what appears to be a silver-colored handgun, meaning that even if the police story were true, Reed would have been unarmed. So again, we have another innocent life lost, a man who was surrendering to those authorities who were trying to take away his freedom and still losing his life in the process.
Oh, man. Oh, boy. I tell you, this is just, I swear, Gus, it's like I was talking to you before the program about, is it that we're just becoming more aware of these incidents, or are they actually increasing exponentially in the last couple of years?
It's definitely increasing exponentially. I mean, you can see ever since conceal and carry, there has been a spike in the murders of African American males by what we call either private vigilante justice or state sponsored violence. Mm-hmm. And there's a definite correlation in that. And that's what black studies scholar Sundiata Chajua has termed the new nadir, that we're reaching levels that were almost to the first nadir in the 1890s to 1920s where African Americans were lynched in various ways to prevent them from reaching into another socioeconomic ladder. You have the same thing going on today. You have people in the streets and in technology online challenging the idea of authority and power because of their ruthlessness, and they're now being silenced by guns, conceal and carry laws, and other legislation that are silencing the masses. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that we need to make sure we are publicizing and putting into the streets so people can organize around those issues. So yeah, it's a definite spike, and we're going to have to match it with resistance.
Indeed. And can you explain to the listeners who may not know what a nadir is?
Yes, the nadir means the lowest point. So it was the lowest point in African American history right after Reconstruction, starting around 1875 after the Vicksburg Massacre, where black politicians were shot in their offices and removed by Southern Democrats to retake what they called, to retake white supremacy in politics, and also to issue out different legislation to repress blacks. So you had lynchings, and there are three parts of the new nadir. It was political subjugation, economic exploitation, meaning that they would no longer be able to get certain jobs and they were held to get the what we call sub-proletariat or sub-working class jobs, and also social humiliation, which means also minstrel shows and making African Americans or people with black skin seem as though they are inferior and lower, so that when these mobs of elite judges, police officers, congressmen, and all these other elites who've organized these lynch mobs, when they did these things, they were basically showing that they're killing nothing but an animal, a character caricature, a cartoon, something that can be ridiculed. So that was the nadir period, where it was the lowest point for African Americans, where we could not progress socially, politically, or economically. And we're getting to that same point. And some people point to the fact that we do have political representation, but you point to any other statistics or indicators in the community, and African Americans have regressed. Education, jobs, I mean, across the board, we are just not having access to opportunities, and they're fracturing our communities at this point. So we are reaching a new nadir.
Yes. And what's interesting about that date you gave, 1875, that was, I believe, the same year as the Great Uprising, the Great Railroad Strike, and when it started spreading, and they called, and when the local police refused to shoot people, they called in the local state National Guard, they refused to shoot people, then they pulled federal troops out of the South.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And turn them against the strikers, and in the same time, leaving the South, the people, you know, that were traditionally in charge there, the plantation class and their surrogates, basically to go on a reign of terror.
Yeah, because, I mean, that was the one point in history, and that's when the new nadir started, because there was a time in history during Reconstruction where the working classes of both African Americans and whites were going together and challenging capitalists and racists to stop things from happening to them in terms of their being able to have some type of socioeconomic progress. They were actually uniting together and organizing against capitalism. Mm-hmm. They were doing those things. And they were doing successfully. So that strike happens. The northern capitalists and also the planter class actually get together and crush whatever the African Americans and the masses of whites were having going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you have, of course, come from that is the sharecropping expanding, the convict lease system expanding, the federal troops leaving the South. So,
okay.
You know, the nadir starts, and lynching just goes
okay.
All over the place.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And so, Gus brought some music for us today. Are you ready for a music break, or do you have one more story?
Yeah, let's go. Let's go ahead and get okay,
some
music
we're gonna,
going.
Okay, and what is this song that's going to play next?
This is Parliament Funkadelic, one of my favorite groups, showing black power, showing the power of the masses. And I'm a band person. I like the groups come together, because it shows what we are as a community. We do things together. So this is one of my favorites from Parliament Funkadelic. It just, if you know it, you'll know it. I like it to be a surprise.
Okay, very good. Now you're listening to World Labor Hour. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
Okay, that was Funkadelic, and I've never heard that too. That's I really like that one. That's great.
Call you and your love.
Okay, all right. So I guess maybe at this point it might be a good time to do some public service announcements. I got quite a few here, and I don't know if Gus brought any or not. But anyway, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, otherwise known as the TPP, the Free Trade Agreement, is NAFTA on steroids, which will severely harm our standard of living and undermine our democracy at the local, state, and national levels. The Trans-Pacific Partnership will affect everything we care about, and that is why it unites us. Together, we can stop it. The President is asking Congress to pass a law called Fast Track that will allow him to sign the agreement before Congress can see it. We must stop Fast Track. Congress is planning hearings on it very soon, and here's what you need to do. Go to stopfasttrack.com and use the tools there to contact your member of Congress. Two, go to flushthetpp.org and take the action pledge. You'll also find tools there. You can write letters to the editor and organize activities to raise awareness in your community. So those two websites are stopfasttrack.com and flushthetpp.org. Okay, and tomorrow, in other words, Sunday, January 25th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center at the downtown Urbana Post Office Building, 202 South Broadway in Urbana, the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice and the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center will host Reclaiming Martin Luther King's Radical Roots as part of a national effort to bring the Black Lives Matter movement into the new year. We want to revisit Martin Luther King's example to bring forth a 21st century grassroots movement. We continue to be haunted by what Dr. King called the triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism. In other words, racism, capitalism, and war. Now more than ever, we need a radical revolution against the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration, police brutality, income inequality, and a criminal justice system keeping African-American youth in shackles. What can we understand today's situations in the light of Martin Luther King's vision, and where does it lead us? There will be invited readers, music, refreshments, and an open mic. You are invited to bring your favorite King speeches and reflections on them, or read from supply copies that they'll be there of his more radical writing. So I'm definitely going to attend that. You going to go to that, Gus?
Oh, yeah. I cannot wait for that.
Okay. I take it you're one of the speakers lined up.
Actually, I'm not going to. I'm actually not going to speak at this one.
Okay.
I think that it'd be. I'm going to be a respondent. I'm going to talk, have a discussion about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I like to not. I like to have everybody else also be involved in speaking at things. So, mm-hmm. You know, I'm just excited to be a part of this type of community that has these types of things. So,
okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, please join us on Thursday, January 29th to continue the effort against new jail construction in Champaign County. Since 2011, we have successfully fought off efforts by Champaign County authorities to spend $20 million on jail building. We thought this idea had gone away, but it's back. On February 3rd, a team of consultants hired for $150,000 will make recommendations for new construction to the county board. We expect the consultants to recommend major jail building. We have to oppose any efforts to spend millions of taxpayers' money on new jail cells. We need programs to keep people out of jail, not build new jail cells, so we will need action in February. We urge you to come to a mass planning meeting to help plan our strategy to oppose construction and promote alternatives. We have succeeded before. We can do it again. Please join us. Add your ideas and your energy. Build programs, not jails. And that's this coming Thursday, January 29th, 6:30 p.m. at the Independent Media Center, downtown Urbana Post Office, 202 North Broadway in Urbana. And you know, there's so many other things needed in the community. I mean, particularly mental health facilities. And not only that, but you know, looking at a lot of statistics, you know, it seems like about a third of the people in the county jail really don't need to be there.
Of course not, but you know, it's a historical fact that you feel jails, you feel pockets of capitalists. So I mean, let's be very transparent and clear that that's the only thing they want to do. You know, it's the school to prison pipeline they're trying to fill. You know,
yes.
We want to make sure that as many people who are not going to be part of our labor force outside of jails and taking these sub working class jobs, that they're going to be in jails to do sub working class work and make ten cents an hour.
Yes.
And fill the pockets of capitalists. So I mean, you know,
yeah,
that's what they want.
Yes, indeed. Okay, and next Saturday on the World Labor Hour, Rich Whitney, the Green Party candidate for governor in 2006, who obtained almost 13% of the vote in Illinois, is going to be a guest on the World Labor Hour, and he's also going to be speaking at the Champaign Public Library from 2 to 3 p.m. And so that's next Saturday, January 31st, from 2 to 3 p.m. at the Champaign Urbana Library. So, and also last but not least, tune in this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. for Labor's Worldview TV. Okay, so Yes.
Yeah, also, just to add in too, on that same Saturday, the North End Men's Breakfast Club, is hosting a Selma viewing at Carmike Theater. We're going to have, possible either two or three showings starting at, 1 o'clock. We'll have more information about that, as time goes on. There'll be flyers passed out, but we're hosting this mainly for the youth of the community. We held a screening, last weekend and it went really well. But the thing that we want to do is we want to make sure we present these opportunities to educate the youth about who, about, you know, just, you know, a film screening is something that we feel as though we can kind of bridge the gap between education and entertainment for the youth. And because the movie is incredibly, incredibly excellent, of course, it has a couple of flaws that we've talked about and we will talk about, but it does a very good job of showing organizing against a particular issue and keeping that goal as the central part of a movement, because that's what sustains movements. So this is something that we're going to have for all people. We reserved the Carmike Theater for about 500 students and youth. So if you can come out, or if you want more information about it, just please, well, I'll be around, so you'll see me around. And the email address you can hit me up at is gwood3@gmail.com. And I apologize for the three eyes, but Google create the email address for me. But this is something we really want to do. So if you can't come out January 31st, the North End Men's Breakfast Club is hosting a viewing of Selma. We're either going to do two viewings or three viewings, depending on how many people do show up. So, okay. And it's going to be $5 per person. So, and we're also taking donations too to do this. And this has become a nationwide story. Paramount Pictures is actually talking about this now, as Champaign being one of the first smaller cities to host a viewing of such a very important movie. So we're very excited about that.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And $5 is really reasonable these days to go to any film for that matter, you know. But I noticed, I didn't really get really involved in it, but I don't know if maybe you picked up on this, but there's been some ruling class media, corporate media criticism of Selma's stuff. Have you picked up on any of that?
Yeah. They don't, you know, when you make a movie where the central figures and the central protagonists are black. Now, again, you had, you know, they made kind of a small stink about 12 Years a Slave, but because that's based on an autobiographical novel by a person who went through it, and then, of course, you had Brad Pitt at the end of the movie, then they were kind of, you know, but in Selma, you have these African Americans. And it's portrayed as them being autonomous, that they have autonomy. They're creating this movement, they're sustaining it, and they're the ones driving it forward. Where a lot of the ruling elite media saying, well, hey, what about President Johnson? You know, what then President Johnson, was he the one that said they should do it? That they gave them permission to do it? The first thing that people need to realize about any type of black freedom movement thing, any type of event in the history of black freedom movements, any type of struggle, including the civil rights movement, the black power movement, we have never asked for permission to do anything from the federal government. You can look back at any group, from the Panthers to the Deacons for Justice and Black Power. You can look at SNCC. You can even SCLC. We don't ask for permission to do things. We organize these things because our people are sick, or they're help. They need help. They need things from us. So that's what that's all about. We have autonomy, and that's what the movie was trying to show, in that we have autonomy. We can create our own organizations. We could push them forward. Now, we will go to the federal government for assistance, but we're not going to go to them for permission.
Yes.
That's a very big point that we were trying to put forth in this movie, and I am so proud of that, of the everybody that was involved in that movie, because it's a step forward. It's a major step forward in making movies about black struggle, you know.
Yes, and let's face it, you never get assistance from the federal government unless you you know, force them to do it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what was the famous quote from Frederick Douglass on that, about some power concedes nothing without a demand, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And also, I was going to wait till next Saturday, next program, to announce this, but I'm going to be having on Labor's Worldview, during the month of February, I'm going to be showing four really interesting films that relate to the civil rights struggle. And one of them, which is my personal favorite, is called The Children's March. Mm-hmm. And what was behind that is, this is in Birmingham, Alabama, 1963. It was a low point in the civil rights movement. Dr. King was in jail mm-hmm. for quite a long time. It wasn't just an overnight thing. Mm-hmm. I guess he'd been there for, I think he spent almost a month at this particular point. And everyone was kind of dispirited and stuff. And Birmingham was one of the worst places in the South. Well, I guess a radical minister from Mississippi, whose name escapes me, joined up with a Birmingham radio disc jockey, and they started organizing high school youth because they tried to organize the adults to try to do something against the segregation in downtown Birmingham, where all the adults were just so poor they couldn't afford to mm-hmm. even take off a day at work, much less go to jail, possibly lose their jobs. So it was the kids that got things changed. Mm-hmm. It started with the high school kids, and it progressed to the junior high and even grade school kids. There were so many people arrested that they had to start putting them in the stock pavilions at the county fairgrounds, yep. which once they started getting media images of that thrown around, shown around the country, it was a national outrage. And only then did President Kennedy finally come out and say he was going to send FBI and federal troops to the South. But it was before then, he tried to stay out of it.
And again, that goes back into the whole idea of when you look at the historical trends of resistance to racism and capitalism, whether it be blacks, whether it be the white working class, any type of group, change only comes from social movements. And you're going to have the federal government intervening. You're going to have other groups coming in after the movements on the ground are established. That's where we learn how to resist and change, is on the ground. And that's a perfect example of that. They're not going to pay attention to anything until we organize something.
Yes. What is it? There's a quote from Dr. King, I believe it was, at one point, talking about the ruling class. And he said that first they'll try to ignore you. Okay. Then they'll try to villainize you. They'll brutalize you. And then when they finally give in, they'll say they're with you all the time and you just went about it the wrong way. So, but okay. You got another music clip here yes. that I wanted to play. Yes. So what is that one?
This is from one of my favorite artists from Houston. He's a hip hop rapper. He's a very famous hip hop rapper from the South. His name is K Reno, and he's representing the South Park Coalition. And you know, Houston is one of the birthplaces of hip hop. And the song is called "Who's the Man," and it's a very appropriate song for what we're talking about, dealing with what happens to me as I feel as an African American when I'm stopped by the police. So.
Okay, yeah. Here we go. You're listening to World Labor Hour. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Down the
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor, our Armless Support Community Radio Station, WFT. So, okay, Gus, you had another, well, actually, this is your main topic today. You want to talk about President Obama's State of the Union address?
Yeah, as we all know, the biggest time of the year, the first quarter of the year is always the State of the Union address, where the president talks about what's happening with the country. So, before we get into it, I just wanted to ask, Dave, how'd you feel about the State of the Union address? We're transparent here.
Okay, I can say it in a real short sentence.
Exactly.
Talk is cheap.
Yeah. And again, and that's really my big thing.
Based on his track record for the last 6 years, 7 years?
Yeah, but let's put it in the context, though.
Yeah, sure.
President Obama is doing the best job he can in the system he's placed in. Because no matter who you put in that system, regardless of what their personality or their activism or what they want to do is, the system is made to corrupt it to fit capitalism and inequality. I mean, let's be honest with you. Think about it. The type of person that a President Obama was and how he ran his campaign when he came in 2008. Mm-hmm. Think about it. Versus who you see speaking and doing things today. Those are two different people. They really are.
Sure.
Because, so I'm just saying, the way, when you get that type of position and the way the foundational system is created, is you cannot hold that position. So, again, I don't think he's the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem is the system that he is a part of.
The system is, of course, it's a system, so. And also, you think about it, what a person has to have in this point in time, what they have to do to be able to get elected president. I mean, you're basically, you're making deals with the devil before you.
Exactly.
When you enter the primaries, look at 2008. I mean, there was, eight candidates maybe. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you had some candidates like Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel talking some pretty controversial stuff, but, you saw real early on how the corporate media treated them and, who they gave attention to, So, that's the problem. It is a systemic problem. No doubt there. And the type of people, discourage people, but look what happened to John Kennedy. I mean, that's mm-hmm. always a possibility.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with some very, very powerful and ruthless people.
Exactly.
That I call it the real government. There's another term for it, the deep government, deep state or something like that.
Exactly.
Different terms for it. Yeah.
Now, regardless of how I said that about the president, we have to be able to constructively criticize what he is doing and what the government as a whole is doing, because there are parts to the government that he does not control and we must criticize them. So one of the quotes that I picked up that he said is exactly that: the shadow of crisis has passed for the U.S. economy, and that thanks to its bustling industry, America has risen from the recession, with the recovery touching more and more lives and wages finally starting to rise again. Well, it's time to, I'm a historian and I'm a social scientist, so I like to go through the data. I like data. So let's take a look at what the U.S. Census Bureau said. It said between 2012 and 2014, the median household income in, I'll just do one state, in New Jersey, dropped by 0.4%. And what's most alarming is that between those same years, the number of people living in poverty in New Jersey rose by 6.8% to 998,549 people, or 11.4% of the state of New Jersey.
Wow.
So, wow. And in Mississippi, it's even worse. Almost a quarter of all people living in the state of Mississippi are at or below the poverty line. 22.5% poverty rate, and 17% of those same people are without any type of insurance.
Wow.
Yeah. And even though, and again, those national indicators are not even really historically accurate. They're actually technically a bit off. And here, let me give you an example. In 2013, an individual living in the continental United States must make less than $11,490 a year to be counted as officially poor. So if I made $12,000 that year, I'm not poor. Now, those of you listening, if you made $12,000 a year, could you feed yourself or feed anybody else in your family in this country with the rising cost of living and everything else? No, you cannot. No, you cannot. But of course, if you make anywhere over $11,490 a year, then they will not count you as poor, which is utterly ridiculous. For a family of four, the poverty level is $23,550. Can a family of four even live on $28,000 in this country? No, you cannot. You cannot support a family and have a livable wage at that amount. So again, these national indicators are flawed, but it points to a very big crisis forming in our country, and that wages are stagnating or regressing in many industries, and jobs that are being created are sub-working class, meaning you cannot create a livable situation or a family and sustain it over time. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute, on what it means to be working class versus the other classes in the country, which are middle class, and then of course the smallest one, the capitalist elite class.
Okay. Yes. You know, a really good point, that has, been brought up to me here is that, you know, take one good 40-hour job, split it up into two or three crummy part-time jobs with no benefits, make some, you know, employment figures look better. Three jobs instead of one. And, remember that scene where George W. Bush was on some talk show and this woman said she had three jobs? He goes, "Oh, isn't that wonderful? That's uniquely American." Yeah. That's supposed to be something good.
Exactly. It used to be, I mean, it was supposed to be something good, and they advertised it as something good, but it's, you know, life is already very difficult to live, and then to live in America, and then to live as an African American or a Latino or a Native American, and yet you pile this on top of it, this, the economic situation, you know, it's incredibly heart-wrenching. And again, a lot of people are very confused about the president's remarks, and I want to be very clear about class. Because President Obama has always talked about he wants to help the middle class, the struggling middle class. So let's be clear. What is the middle class and what is the working class? The working class, the great majority of Americans form the working class. Here's what they are. They are either skilled or unskilled in manufacturing and in services, men and women of all races, nationalities, and religions. They drive trucks. They write routine computer code. They operate machinery. They wait tables. They sort and deliver the mail. They work on assembly lines. They stand all day as bank tellers and fast food workers, and they perform thousands of jobs in every sector of the economy. For all their differences, working class people share a common place in production where they have relatively little control. Listen to this. They have little control over the pace or content of their work. And they aren't anybody's boss. That is key. They have no control over their own production. They produce the wealth of nations, but receive from that wealth only what they can buy with the wages their employers pay them. When we add them all up, they account for over 60% of the labor force. Over 60% of Americans in this country are working class. The majority of this country is working class. They are the working class majority. There is also a middle class. It includes professional people, small business owners, and managers and supervisors who have authority over others at work. But the middle class is only a little more than half the size of the working class. Instead of seeing them as people with middling income, we will see them as people with middling authority. The middling class is caught between the working class and the capitalist class in what Karl Marx would deem the petite bourgeois. So.
Okay. You know, even in that category, like say, physicians, you know, it's rare for a physician to have his own private practice anymore. They're usually employees of, you know, hospitals or clinics.
Exactly. And even going below that, if you really want to break it down, this is a little bit of my social science going in there. There's an excellent social scientist named Martin Oppenheimer who talks about what Karl Marx, he breaks down what Karl Marx was talking about with the subproletariat, which is that group below the working class, Oppenheimer termed dirty workers, because their work is unskilled. It is always physically exhausting. It is always uncomfortable. And we're talking dishwashers in restaurants, fast food workers as well. Work that utilizes a minimum of machinery, labor intensive, and unionization is non-existent. Hence, there is a low level of job wage and safety protection. And that's what's actually starting to rise in this country, is the idea of the subproletariat, the sub-working class, because those are the majority of the jobs that were created since the Great Recession. So there are tons of jobs being created, yes, but they're jobs that are requiring no unionization, no health care, low wages, and unskilled labor. So this is what a lot of our youth have to face when they spend all this money and go into debt and go to college. This is what they have to face when they leave. It's either you're going to have a very small chance of getting that middle class job. You're going to have an okay chance of getting that working class job, but you're going to have an even better chance of getting that sub working class job. So
yeah, how many people working at Starbucks around the country have bachelor's or even master's degrees?
Woo.
I mean, it's high. I mean, in fact, the highest rate of unemployment of any category of people out there are students. You know, graduates, basically students that have a bachelor's degree or more. I mean,
exactly.
Which is, you know, it says something about the system. And also, you know, as far as policies to try to correct a lot of this poverty and inequality, one thing was suggested by, of all people, Republican President Richard Nixon about a guaranteed minimum income, you know. And I always, you know, I thought that was a good idea in principle, sort of, but it's like the only problem I have with it is that, you know, you kind of letting corporations off the hook as far as, you know, externalizing their costs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I always thought, though, that maybe a combination of guaranteed minimum, real adequate minimum wage, which, of course, you know, $15 an hour for a nationwide one is okay, but, man, people that live in Chicago, New York, Boston, they're going to need at least $20 an hour to even be close to the $15 an hour minimum wage, say, if you live in some rural area or a relatively small town, you know. But nevertheless, you know, the combination of the two would work, but I don't see anything even coming close moving in that direction, you know, at this point in time.
And
anyway,
the scary thing about it is when they do go up to that minimum wage, which we spoke about earlier, like in Seattle, they're not going to be able to match that cost of living. So when they do, like in 2022, and they get to $18 or $19 an hour, the cost of living is going to be double what it was before. So they're going to need more. So that's how capitalism works. There's no way you can break that profit margin. That's the way the system is made. So again, until we learn how to restructure the system instead of trying to change a part of it, we're just going in circles.
Yes. You know, besides Obama's State of the Union message, there was address. There was also a couple responses, one from Green Party Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's very much into the single-payer healthcare movement. Also, one from Socialist City Council member in Seattle, Kashama Sawant, in which she's talking about, you know, she critiques Obama's address and talks about, in the city of Seattle, a 400% increase in rents as far as the inner city of Seattle. Because now, it's like, all the people with the higher incomes want to live in the city centers. Back when I was a young man in the 70s, they all wanted to run out the suburbs, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to love going to inner cities, and now you can't afford anything in inner city as far as staying somewhere that's modest, or, you know, finding small little neighborhood you know, restaurants or in cheap entertainment. Now it's all geared towards people with incomes of $100,000 or more, you know.
Of course, yeah, because the neoliberalism is doing this this retaking of the cities now, because they are the networks of capitalism in these cities now. They're no longer hubs of industry anymore, since that's gone. So now we're just going to recreate this stuff using the new technology with the internet and being able to control capitalism globally from these networks in these cities. So of course they're going to retake the cities now, because that's where they know they don't have to worry about living with people who can't afford to be there, and they can control capitalism a lot easier that way. So
yes, indeed. And you know what, Kashama Sawant, pretty much, I mean, you know, she was pretty lengthy here in her address, but one thing I wanted to point out, her main theme here was that we cannot count on or trust politicians to, you know, make our lives better, that we basically have to form a working class movement nationwide, starting at the local level. Basically, work locally, but network nationally, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Again, you know, that's one of the best things that Lenin realized, is that you have to start locally. You have to spray. You have to leaflet. You have to drop pamphlets everywhere. You have to find as much paper as you can. You have to get in the voice of as many people on the ground as you can, and spread and propagandize the real facts about what's going on with the people, and show the disparities. We have to document. We have to become, we have to really become our own, like in Africa, the griots, the ones who speak the history. We have to be able to do that everywhere and tell people and document inequality, whether it be race, class, capitalism, gender, sex, whatever it is, you have to document it, and you have to propagandize it and expose it as much as you can. And once you do that, that's how you make those national connections. That's how you sustain movements, because you're putting that objective at the fore. Mm-hmm. It's very important. So yeah, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah. So, what else did you find, interesting about the President Obama's, address?
And people that know me know when they ask me about President Obama, they've already heard this, those that are listening. But one of the biggest criticisms I have of the president, this is something that he can't control that I think he really needs to take, become very aggressive about is his stance on racism. Those that have heard the president speak, he has still not addressed anti-black racism in this country as a black struggle. He only uses the term communities of color to homogenize the issue. That's a very big problem to me. He refuses to address racial oppression as anti-black racism. Community of color, when you say that, it devalues the struggle of each particular group. Black Americans have experienced a historically and contemporarily distinct degradation, domination, and exploitation. Slavery, sharecropping, being used as scab fodder for capitalists during union strikes. Latino Americans, Asians, and Native Americans, they have their own distinct struggles. They come from different eras. They have different variations of exploitation. Calling it communities of color devalues and erases the lives and the struggles and resistance of the people who do these things for Native Americans and Latinos and for African Americans. It erases the Trayvon Martins. It erases the Kewan Carringtons, the Michael Browns, the Eric Gardners, and every other everyday person. You're taking away the autonomy of community organizing. So I'm not talking about these elite leaders, these people that go into communities and try to organize them. I'm talking about the people that work 8 hours a day, who go home, they feed their children, and they go to a meeting to organize an event to stop racism or capitalism in their community. They're erasing that by homogenizing and saying communities of color. We need to address inequality the way it is really labeled. If an African American is killed, it is anti-black racism. If a group of Latinos are deported out of the country, that's anti-Latino discrimination and racism. Let's just call it what it is. We have to start identifying what these things are, because if we do not, we are doing a disservice to the people who are struggling on the ground, and we are not going to be able to actually resist appropriately. We have to have a dialectical relationship between the oppression and the resistance. And if we don't identify what it is, how can we form a resistance around it? There is no objective that can be formed.
Yeah, if you can't describe the problem, then the problem doesn't exist.
Exactly. So yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's really my only thing that I've noticed with, and of course, those of you that heard the State of the Union from President Obama, everybody knows that he's one of the greatest speakers to ever live. I mean, that's obvious.
I agree with
this point. There's no, I mean, seriously, he's up there. But again, we've had a lot of great speakers in history, but we haven't had a lot of great, people who have changed things in history. We've had a few, but we haven't had a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people can speak, but very few can do. So
that's a very good distinction. Yes.
So that's why I'll leave it at with that. And it's, I have. You know.
Yeah. When I said earlier, you asked me my opinion. Talk is cheap. I mean, I was referring to basically all these things he was promising. You know, seriously,
but,
I mean, why didn't they do this back in 2009, 2010 when the Democrats had the House, the Senate, and the presidency? He knows that he can't get this passed with the current Congress. So, I mean, so it seems like to me the only reason he'd say that is just to try to kind of shine up the image of the Democratic Party, because they took a real beating this last time in the primaries, because people are fed up and they don't know what else to do but to stay home or to sometimes even vote against a Democrat because they're disgusted with what they've been doing, selling people out, basically,
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that President Obama has to do, I think, at this point in his career is he has to, I won't necessarily say it's self-preservation at this point, but he knows that he's going to take a really bad beating because of what's happening with the Congress. So what he has to do is he has to really try to put forth a valiant effort. And that's what I think the speech was about, that I'm not just going to give up. I know you all know I really got my behind whooped in these elections. I just want the people of America to know that I'm not giving up and I'm going to continue to try to fight. And I think that's what the whole purpose of the speech was, is to show the people that I'm not just going to give up, because a lot of people are already saying that. What's the point of you even doing? You have no power at this point. Use your executive orders like crazy Andrew Johnson did back in the day, or other presidents. I mean, other than that. So.
Well, but then you have the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
I mean, he wants fast-track authority. He's more in agreement with the majority of the Republicans on this than he is the majority of the Democrats, you know. I mean, he's pushing hard for this. I mean, if he pushed half as hard as trying to, bring civil rights, charges against, George Zimmerman for killing Trayvon Martin, man, I mean, he'd probably be in jail now, you know, as opposed to run out there, you know.
But here's the thing though. Yes. That's important though. I'm glad you said that because we need something like that. We need some type of disruption to the system. That's how systems collapse. That's historical. You have a disruption to the system where a federal official acknowledges a racist component of the system and does something that can disrupt the flow of the whole system and break it apart. Mm-hmm. It may not stop at that same day or that same year, but in the future, you know, revolutions don't happen overnight. 2 or 3 years down the road, there could be a pattern of events that could lead to a restructuring of the system if he did something like that. And his legacy would be amazing. I mean, let's remember, there are a lot of people who were not celebrated because they did so-called unpopular things when they did them. But now that we look back at it, I mean, they changed the system. We can imagine how, and I'm going to go ahead and use what the people love to do now, textbook Samuel Adams and George, you know, the things that they were doing were disrupting systems.
Mm-hmm.
They were revolutionaries. They're doing the things that, because they believe the system they were in was oppressive and exploitative.
Mm-hmm.
They disrupted the system. And at the time, very few people thought that what they were doing was right.
Yes.
But then, of course, during the revolution, as years went on, they started getting along with them. And now, of course, we put them on money. You know what I'm saying? that's what kills me. And that goes back into the hypocrisy of how things work, because there is an inequality built in the American system. And until we have a disruption of that, then it's going to be very difficult to change.
So. Indeed. And so, you know, any last words, Gus, here as far as on the program?
Yeah, one of the things I'm going to do at the end of every show is I'm going to bring about a part of something that's big for me and my culture is film. I'm very big on film. So one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to give a recommendation for labor and race on film at the end of every show. And for this week, it's a very hard to find aspect, but some of the older listeners and some of the people who enjoy television know of a series called The Outer Limits.
Oh, yeah.
That came out in 1963. Not the newer ones, the 1990s that came out on Showtime and all the other stuff. I'm talking about the original black and white 1963 Outer Limits show. It is probably one of the greatest scarring criticisms on race and capitalism ever made. Every single episode was a socioeconomic conversation about what is happening in society and how we want to change things. I honestly believe
I'm going to have to get those reruns because I remember seeing it, but I was very, very young.
Yeah, see, I watch it all the time.
But I love it. For some reason, it was intriguing.
It's amazing. I have every episode memorized. It drives my work, and I watched it when I was younger because of my mother. My mother introduced me to The Outer Limits, and she's very big on these types of things.
Okay.
So one episode I want you to check out is an episode called A Feasibility Study. And remember, find the black and white version and not the newer version because they remade it. And a feasibility study is a scarring critique of American slavery, because what happens is a group, and the show is based around science fiction, and that every show has something to do with extraterrestrials or aliens or monsters, but it's still, the context of it is inequality of racism and capitalism in America. So what happens is you have a group of aliens who are lazy, who don't do anything. They're immobile. They're physically and literally immobile, and they kidnap a neighborhood of unsuspecting Americans and transport them to another planet to do slave labor for them. And the way that the episode is set up is so amazing, because you actually meet the aliens and they say, we cannot move, and you're going to create our worldly goods for us, and you're not going to make any money off of it. If you do survive what we do here, guess what happens? We're going to abduct the entire Earth population. So we're going to take this group of slaves, and if you do good, we're going to take the rest of you later on. So what happens, and again, I'm not spoiling the ending or anything, but what ends up happening is that the people actually organize autonomously their resistance. How do we fight this? We have to save our people. And they end up sacrificing themselves, because if you touch one of the aliens, you actually become immobile yourself. There's a disease that you get from touching one of them. So one of them touches an alien, and then they grab the hand of the other person, and that person grabs the hand of the other person, and they end up killing themselves to save the rest of the world. That's how they resisted slavery. And that was a major thing with the person who wrote The Outer Limits, was to show that resistance is a powerful aspect of beating power and hegemony. So that's one of my favorite episodes, and it drives my work. If you get a chance to catch it, it's on DVD. You can catch episodes on YouTube as well, and I'm going to do this every week, but that's, I'm telling you, it is one of the most earth-shattering shows in terms of how complex it looks at race, class, gender, sexuality, and power in this country.
That's amazing. That is simply amazing. Well, Gus, thank you so much. This has been a really great premiere show of yours, we're just so happy to have you on board here. So you've been listening to the World Labor, our unlisted-supported community radio station, WFT, in Champaign, Illinois. And just to let you know, we're going to be going out with some music from Twice Thou, and Union Edge will be coming shortly, but let you know that there's going to be some transmission work being done on our transmitter, so that during the hour of the Union Edge from 12 to 1, there's going to be some downtime, so just prepare for that. So until next week, take care, and power to the people.
Power to the people.